Hello. This is actually a talk that has been given before at this very conference. It used to be called Speaking the Worldview Vernacular, back when I felt like it needed to sound more pretentious and scholarly. And I'm sort of past that. I'm recovering. It's all good. But it's now called Popologetics. And that is, it's also the title of a book I just got out, May 7th. So if you don't get anything that I say, or if you're fuzzy on some of them, you know, throw out questions. I don't mind stopping. I think we have a little more time to stretch our legs. I do want to reserve a little bit of time to do a couple of workshopping things at the end. But don't be shy. And if you don't get to a question or there's something that is left unexplored for you, chances are I've written a book that is, I think it's something like 358 pages. If it's not in there, then it just can't be answered. So this is a true story. At this very conference some years ago, it was last day and we were all packing up and eating breakfast. And I was sitting at the table beside an apologist, an internationally known, fairly brilliant man who shall rename nameless to protect the guilty. And we were talking about this and that, and he said, "What do you do?" And I said, I'm a college lecturer. I teach in cultural and religious studies. And I told him about one of my favorite classes called Popular Culture and Media Theory. And about how it's a survey of different thinkers who have shaped popular culture, the ways that we think about popular culture, Marx and Foucault and all that. And he kind of sat back in his chair and thoughtfully stroked his chin and said, "Why would anybody want to study that?" You know, and it was an innocent question. I had, at that point, been studying popular culture for about 20 years, so it might have been a tad tactless, but I wish his sentiments were somehow atypical. When I tell people I study popular culture, their reaction, and they're Christians, their reaction is either, "Wow, that's really cool," which is a relatively new thing in the evangelical world, or they kind of look at me like as if I dissected slugs for a living or something like that. And you can understand, you know, who cares about World of Warcraft or Madonna or Lady Gaga or any of those people? So he was brutally honest, more direct than many would have been, but it's not a completely unknown response. Let me respond to his response with a few juicy quotations of my own. This is from science fiction and technology writer Bruce Sterling. "If religion is the opiate of the people, then immersive multiplayer 3D virtual worlds are hardcore Afghani heroin." This is Bono. "Anyway, I stopped going to churches and got into a different kind of religion. Don't laugh. That's what being in a rock and roll band is. Showbiz is shamanism, music is worship. Whether it's worship of women or their designer, the world or its destroyer, whether it comes from that ancient place we call soul or simply the spinal cortex, whether the prayers are on fire with a dumb rage or dove-like desire, the smoke goes upward to God or usually something you replace God with, usually yourself." And finally, Camille Paglia, a post-feminist, somebody who kind of gets under everybody's skin. "Popular culture is the new Babylon into which so much art and intellect, bless you, now flow. It is our imperial sex theater, supreme temple of the Western eye, the pagan past, never dead, flames again in our mystic hierarchies of stardom." Now, what ties these three provocative quotations together? In a word, the connection between religion and popular culture, interactive multiplayer virtual worlds in the first, rock and roll in the second, and popular culture as a whole, especially the cult of celebrity in the third. And whether or not you agree with the specifics of every quote, the point they make is fairly valid. Popular culture is a player in the realm of the sacred, in the realm of ultimate meanings. And I'm not sure that Christians get that. And the purpose of this talk is to help you get that and to help you know what to do with it.
Did you repeat that?
Repeat what?
Just the last line.
That popular culture is a player in the realm of the sacred, in the realm of ultimate meanings. A lot of times, apologetics, the way we traditionally do it, often fails to make an impact on people's worldviews, and it fails to do so for a fairly simple reason. It doesn't deal with people where they actually live. And where do they live? They live in worlds suffused with popular culture. In Western civilization, including continental Europe, popular culture has emerged in the last 50 to 70 years as being one of the most, if not the most, important and fertile centers of the construction and distribution of meanings on the planet. Popular culture, and all of this meaning-making and meaning-distributing, has a definite impact on worldviews. Popular culture has, in a sense, become a substitute for religion. If we really want to engage unbelief, and I think that's part of why you're here, then and it's really hard not to engage unbelief if you live in Europe today, unless you've taken a vow of silence and have gone to live in a cave. If you really want to connect with unbelievers today, you must connect also with popular culture. And that's the point I want to argue. I also want to explore the issue of how popular culture influences worldviews. And then we'll spend some time exploring how we might respond apologetically, hence the title Popologetics. So the impact of popular culture on worldview. It's not exactly like this, not exactly like the Cambrian explosion or whatever this, the extinction of the dinosaurs. Popular culture deeply affects people at the level of their imaginations. So popular culture impacts people at the level of their imaginations. That is, at their deepest desires and motivations, which in turn inform their worldviews, which are articulations of their imaginations and understandings of the world. To give just a couple of examples, think of how men in the West have changed the way they think about women and sex and beauty since the publication of Playboy began in 1953. Or think about how we understand fame and material success under the influence of the many popular culture celebrity shows and celebrity magazines. Think of how Nike ads have changed the way we think about our own bodies, about exercise, about pain. Just do it! Do it! Think of how Tolkien's books and the movies inspired by the books, yes, better close that door, have shaped our understanding of heroism, sacrifice, and evil. Think of the way our sense of humor has changed since the airing of The Simpsons in 1989. In America, which is, for better or for worse, the land of popular culture par excellence, there is a generational divide between those who are too old to have seen or enjoyed Star Wars, that would be episode 4 for you youngsters, when it came out in 1977, and those who have seen it 10 times or more, which is my generation and younger. Star Wars became, for some Americans, a quasi-religion, and for many it crystallized a turn away from religion, organized religion, to spirituality. Popular culture has an immense impact on us and on our worldviews that borders on the religion. And in the case of Star Wars in particular, it has become an actual religion, right? For you people from the UK, what's the fifth most populous religion in the UK now? It goes Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Sikh, and
Jedi.
Right? This is... You know, and for some people who are filling out the census, it was a joke. But for everybody filling out the census? So my point is simply popular culture affects us and those around us on the level of worldview. That is, the assumptions we make about everyday reality through the creation of imaginative worlds that we are invited to inhabit, at least for a little while. And I'll talk more about that a little later. Popular culture works aesthetically, emotionally, imagistically, imaginatively, rather than simply appealing to bare rationality through argumentation. A song or a movie that denies the existence of God is so much more than an argument against the existence of God. And we need an apologetic that can respond to the subtle, rich, and multivalent influences of popular culture. The problem is that the way we so often do apologetics completely ignores popular culture and is ill-equipped to deal with it in any case. The traditional method of apologetics defines itself in this way. Apologetics is a science that endeavors to show that Christianity is the most rational option among all worldview options through the use of evidences of various kinds, whether that's historical evidence for the resurrection, scientific evidence for intelligent design, or argumentative logic, which lays out arguments for the existence of God. And while these arguments, I don't want to slam those things, while these arguments are insightful and interesting often, sometimes they don't seem to connect with our hearers. Why not? Well, because there's a problem with the traditional approach. It tends to misunderstand the people that we talk to. These people are not simply logical brains with legs, or even without legs in the case of this guy. They are rather whole creatures that are embedded, immersed in certain cultures, including environments saturated with popular cultural texts. And I'm going to be talking about texts. What I mean by text is not just books or magazine articles, but also television shows, radio, songs you hear on the radio, movies, all these sorts of things. Anything that can be interpreted is potentially a text. The second way it misunderstands people is that the people we connect with, the people we are talking to, are not neutral about God. They are also fallen and rebellious creatures for whom popular culture often serves as a way of keeping God at arm's length. And they, as a way of providing substitute gods. It isn't as if the people we talk to don't know God. According to Romans 1:18 through 25, unbelievers are fairly swimming in the knowledge of God. For those of you who don't know Romans 1:18 through 25, the wrath of God is being revealed against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness and swap it out for idolatry. So they actively suppress the knowledge of God within them, exchange it for idols, or in this case, idols. And popular culture plays a huge role in that suppression and God-swapping activity. And both of these aspects, cultural embeddedness and this rebellious suppression of God's revelation and substituting an idol for God, express themselves in worldview. So perhaps we need to rethink our strategy for engaging unbelief. Because unbelief is not simply a form of irrationality. That is, it's not simply about an incorrect handling of facts or evidence. More significantly, unbelief is at its core a system of, as it says in Romans 1, revelation suppression and God substitution, also known as idolatry. And that suppression and substitution dynamic needs to be engaged at a level deeper than simply arguing about facts and evidences. Rather, it needs to be engaged at the level of worldview interpretation. These idol-driven worldviews need to be engaged imaginatively using arguments, to be sure, but arguments that deal with the complex imaginative structures circulating in popular culture. Popular culture affects worldview, and we need an apologetic that is equipped to deal with popular culture's influence in worldview. Now, before I lay out such an apologetical approach, I want us to understand the nature of the influence of popular culture on worldview. How does popular culture influence us? One group of conservative cultural critics tends to see the influence of popular culture as sort of this overwhelming, insistent influence that just kind of batters upon our passive minds, so that we are manipulated, we are changed, without even being aware that we're being changed, or only dimly aware. This model thinks of popular culture as something like a whale. Here, a nice fin whale. How does a fin whale eat its food? Anybody know? It opens its mouth and it draws in all the little helpless creatures, the plankton and the krill, and they go into that. In a like fashion, these critics argue this massive effect of popular culture just kind of opens its maw and we're like, oh, we're sucked in. It is a pervasive, inescapable influence that just kind of affects us willy-nilly. We are changed just because popular culture is everywhere and its messages are so darn insistent and batter us again and again. I call this the direct assault model. That is, popular culture's influence boils down to a direct assault of an active popular culture upon passive minds by virtue of popular culture's superior force. Of course, there is something to be said for the direct assault approach. Popular culture is pervasive. It's all around us. It is insistent. Its messages come at us again and again. However, I'm skeptical about the direct assault model for the simple reason that it doesn't explain the depth of our interaction with popular culture, because it never really deals with popular culture as a meaningful form of communication. It never deals with the way that not only do we absorb, but we actively appropriate the message popular culture gives us and incorporate those into our worldview. Let me give you an example. There was a study done among religious teenagers in the 1990s, a kind of a survey of religious attitudes among teenagers in the 1990s. And this lady found that teenagers in the 1990s were way more open to the supernatural, to believing, to having a space in their worldview for the supernatural, for things like auras and ghosts and UFOs and nowadays vampires and things like that. Why? Because they were influenced by shows like The X-Files and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It's not that just that these things kind of smack them in their head and they change. It's that they saw this and they said, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they kind of mined them and incorporated that stuff into their worldview. So I would like to argue that when we are faced with popular culture, we are less like plankton and krill being sucked into the maw of the beast, and more like beavers building their lodges. We interact and use the meanings we find in popular culture to build up meaning lodges, homes of meaning for ourselves to dwell in. Little worldview apartments, cubbies for ourselves to dwell in. Of course, the beaver metaphor isn't perfect either. We tend to be manipulated by popular culture. Beavers are not manipulated by pieces of wood, you know, so it's not perfect. But my point is simply that the interaction between worldview and popular culture is rarely simple. It's complex. And the direct assault approach gives us very few tools to deal with that complexity and subtlety. It is likely that popular culture's influence on us is a combination of passive absorption and active appropriation, krill-flavored beavers, if you will. But however we understand the influence of popular culture, we have to understand its impact on worldview. So, thus far, I've spoken in fairly general terms about the influence of popular culture on worldview. What does this look like in more detail? I think of the process as cyclical. That is, producers of popular culture produce texts, television shows and movies and so forth, out of a certain worldview lens, a grid. which is then seen by audiences and enjoyed by them, and it alters their worldview lens. And then these audiences give feedback to the popular cultural producers through things like advertising revenue, ratings, box office revenue, things like that, but also in more subtle, harder to quantify mediums like changes in cultural attitudes and different ethoses and things like that. Because cultural producers are also cultural receivers. They're in both positions. And that inspires the cultural producers to produce other texts after it alters their worldview. And that cycle happens again and again. And the effect of that cycle, of that cycle of meaning and reception and feedback and all of that, is what we call meaning. It is the kind of at-homeness you feel in your own culture and the at-homeness that evaporates when you go to another culture. You know, you sort of know how your own culture works. All of that is different. It's this circulation of meaning that gives each of our cultures its unique texture. But I've still dodged the question. Yes?
Can you give us an example of the way in kind of current, in a certain time period, that exact process has occurred?
Okay, sure. Let me take a really obvious example. Ang Lee produces, who's got some directorial cred because he's done everything, produces a movie or directs a movie called Brokeback Mountain, right? Which was kind of cutting edge, groundbreaking, edgy, about two cowboys that fall in love. And he says, I don't want to make a gay film. I wanted to make a film about love. All right. That film had enormous impact. If you are at all in touch with American news, think about the debate about gay marriage before Brokeback Mountain and the debate about gay marriage after Brokeback Mountain. And Hollywood producers received that feedback, knew that the climate was changing. Gay right activist groups kind of jumped on that. And after that, Oscars, you want to get an Oscar? You make a gay film. You make a film that deals realistically and brutally with homosexuality. And that all of a sudden became a marketable area of popular culture. Chris Nolan's Batman movies, after lying fallow for a while, made the super, that and Spider-Man, made the superhero genre, that part, alive again. And now we've got a plethora, and the people can't get enough of superhero after Ang Lee almost killed it with his Hulk movie. So, I know. So there's, I don't know if that helps. And that's a really sledgehammer kind of example, and I don't want to get into gay rights debate, but that's sort of the thing. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I don't want to go to the gay rights debate either, but the Ang Lee story is interesting because following Brokeback Mountain and then the Oscars, and then there's another movie comes along, but you also see it then ripple into the sitcoms on television.
Yep, yeah, exactly. Yeah. For those of you listening at home, the brother just said, and Ang Lee's effect on popular culture kind of bled out into television, into popular opinion, which is exactly what I'm meaning. It opened up a whole new market of popular culture, a whole new genre. And just to say, Ang Lee didn't create that sort of thing. There were already, Al Mohler did a really nice piece on the sorts of beliefs within America about choice and about freedom and things like that, which sort of made the whole gay marriage debate and the direction it's going kind of inevitable. And I think Ang Lee was bright enough or maybe just instinctual enough to say the time's right for this story now. So I've still kind of ducked the question, how do individual popular cultural texts influence the worldview lens? How does that shift in worldview happen? To answer that question, I'm going to ask you to think back to going to the movie theater, maybe when you were smaller, because they don't do this so much in movie trailers anymore. And the movie trailers always, when I was a kid, began, or often began, with a phrase that was so cliche that it's become sort of an industry joke now. In a world, right? That's how they start. In a world, and then you put any dire situation you please. In a world where love is hard to find and hard times follow you wherever you go. In a world where being different can spell trouble. In a world where giant rabbits rule through fear and intimidation. You know, that sort of thing. The convention may be cliche, but it points to something that is profoundly true. That is, popular cultural texts, products, and I would argue films in particular, create imaginary worlds of meaning for us to inhabit. They create these worlds of meaning for us to inhabit. That's what they do. Popular cultural texts project worlds of meaning and invite us in to live there for a little while. In fact, I think we should start thinking about worldviews as things that are embedded into the very narrative and stylistic structures of popular culture, of these popular cultural worlds, and that the very shape of these worlds is the thing that influences worldviews. So when we talk about worldviews in relation to popular culture, we need to remember that a worldview is not simply some philosophical or religious label that we attach to a movie or a song or a television show or whatever, like this, like some manifesto stapled onto it. That some cultural critics do that. You know, this is a New Age book. This is a materialistic or atheistic movie or whatever. That might be true at one level, but I think it's profoundly misleading on another. It makes it seem as though if you've understood the label, you've understood the way that is being projected in popular culture. Rather, we need to keep in mind that the worldview is something woven into the specific, unique narrative and stylistic structures of the popular cultural text and its imaginative world that you're listening to or playing or watching. The worldview is all about the contours of this imaginative landscape of the world that the creators of this particular piece of popular culture have produced. So we need to interpret these complex worlds, not simply place labels on them. Yes? What she's saying is when Christians create popular culture, they sort of feel apologetic that it's that they would organically let the worldview kind of be woven into the structures, the narrative and stylistic structures of the world, the imaginative world they're creating. I think that's exactly right. And that would be, I have another talk, which I didn't get to do this time, called How to Creating Authentic Christian Popular Culture. And I think that Christians in particular feel a burden to make their piece of popular culture into a kind of, you know, slogan and or make it into this manipulative tearjerker or a kitschy thing. And it's just deadly. It is through the specific shape of these popular cultural worlds that our own worldview is influenced. As theologian and cultural critic Kevin Van Hooser reminds us, popular culture rarely influences worldview directly. Instead of addressing our belief systems head-on, cultural works structure our daily practices and colonize our imaginations. And I would add that popular culture colonizes our imagination because we colonize their imaginary worlds. So, a few thoughts on engaging popular culture apologetically. If all that I've said is true, that popular culture really does influence our imaginations and worldviews, then we need to engage it. And I would argue that we need to engage it apologetically. That's what you do with religious and worldview challenges if you're a Christian. Well, or you have a crusade, but I don't think that's a really good option anymore. So I want to lay out a popular cultural apologetic. But before I do so, I want to remind you that the people that you talk to when you're talking about popular culture, or even when you're engaging with popular culture, they already know God at some level, right? Romans 1, 1:21, for although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God. So your real task as an apologist engaging their popular culture-formed world is to come alongside them and remind them of something gently that they already know. That they already know deep down, something that they are inexplicably drawn to and horrified and repelled by at the same time. You can connect with them at the level of what they know as true and excellent, at the level of desire and imagination through popular culture. Also, I want to add that some people say, oh, but doing that would spoil all the fun. This is not true. It doesn't spoil the fun. It actually helps you enjoy the piece of popular culture more deeply, as well as being faithful to Christ. You got to be careful with it. You know, you can't see a movie. You got to let yourself kind of experience it. I remember watching years and years ago. My wife and I went to see Fisher King, which is a wonderful Terry Gilliam movie. And as soon as we walked out of the theater, I was saying, "Oh yeah, I can see these motifs of romanticism and the madman as being the prophet and blah blah blah." And she said, "Just shut up for a moment. Just let me enjoy the film for a little bit." You know, but later we talked about it. So any of you hyperly analytical types out there who are, especially if you're married, take it from me. Give them space. You know, be patient. All right, so I'm going to show 5 steps for engaging popular culture. First of all, what's the story? Every popular cultural text contains a story, even if implicitly. We human beings love stories. We are story-addicted creatures, and that is why I would say 97% of popular culture out there is of story form. So ask, what's the story? Let me give you an example. Take a blues song. My baby done left me. She hurt me so bad. She was the best gal I ever had. Now I've got the blues all day long. It's a story, right? I had a baby. Baby done left. I'm hurt. I have the blues. You know, that's kind of denouement, you know, crescendo, denouement. So when you do that, how many people here have studied literature? Okay, you guys get an edge up. You know, never let anyone tell you that having a degree in literature is good for one thing and one thing only, asking, would you like me to supersize that order of fries, ma'am? It's not true. It's not true.
Oh, I see.
No, if you've studied literature, then you know what to do with stories. You know what to look for. You're looking for plot points, major plot points. You're looking for the journey, the kind of narrative journey of each of the characters, or what filmmakers call the character arc. You're looking for conflict. You know, is this conflict an external conflict? You know, a father loses his daughter because she's been kidnapped by some evil men, and you know, and now he's, let's do this, you know, and he has to go in and bust it. Or is it about a man who was abused by his father and now finds himself so wounded inside that he cannot have an intimate relationship with anybody anymore? You know, that's an internal conflict. So what's the conflict, and how is it resolved? So pays off to have an English lit major. If you don't, you know, just think through this stuff. There's some resources out there that you can look at. If there is no discernible plot, you know, as there won't be for, say, the interior of a McDonald's restaurant, which I would say is a text, is a popular cultural text, or, you know, a dubstep song is probably not going to have much narrative going on, you know. Everybody dance. That's, you know, what do you do with that? What you look for, if you cannot find a discernible plot, is you look for the mood. And when I mean mood, I mean something very specific. You look for the emotional landscape that is constructed by the style of the text. So you kind of move on to the next step, which is, where am I? In this case, it is the map of the planet Mongo from the Flash Gordon series from the 1940s. As important as understanding the narrative you need to understand the style and kind of the shape, the moral and spiritual shape of the world. What sort of feel does the aesthetic approach of this piece of popular culture give? How would you describe it? Would you describe it as kind of cold and efficient, like an IKEA piece of IKEA furniture, or kind of warm and informal and scruffy, like a country house? Of course, the language through which the style is communicated differs from medium to medium. A movie world is going to be very different from a television world. It's going to be very different again from a song world. It's going to be different again from a computer gaming world. It's going to be different again from a novel world. All of these things have different strengths, different weaknesses, different media. And so it pays to understand at a nuts and bolts level how these worlds are put together. If you're dealing with a movie world, know something about about the visual language of camera angles and lighting and color schemes and all that. Pay attention to how the popular culture says how a specific medium portrays a specific message. Also, you need to ask questions to see what sort of moral and spiritual universe is implied by this piece of popular culture, by the world of the text. What counts as evil? What counts as good? What makes relationships work? What makes them fail? Are relationships even important? What counts as salvation? What counts as condemnation? What do you have to do to be cool? Is coolness even something you need to worry about? What's the monster lurking around the corner? All of these things. Each question you ask is like sending a sonar beep out from a submarine, and it gives you information back. And the more questions you ask, the more specific, the more detailed your constructed picture of the world of the text is going to be. So you want to develop a feel for the text. You ask questions, you observe how it's made, and you get a pretty good feel. You start feeling at home in this world. You develop instincts for how this particular imaginative world functions, and that will give you insight into the specific worldview challenges it poses. Third step, what is good and true and beautiful in this world and why? One of the most common mistakes that apologists and Christians in general make about popular culture is to reject it too quickly. It's easy, too easy, to simply look at a piece of popular culture and say, oh, that's foolishness, that's idolatry, that's evil, that's filthy, and whatever. And I would say there are pieces of popular culture that I would say, if you struggle in that area in your conscience, don't go there. But idols and sin are only a part of what's going on in popular culture. There is also a lot that is good and true and right in them as well. I call these fragments of grace. These are manifestations of the common grace of God that He sheds abroad to everybody, even those who will not be saved. You know, there's special grace theologians talk about as when God gets your heart and brings you out of yourself to Him. And then there's common grace for even those people who will never be shaken of their idolatry. God loves them, wants to show how generous He is, and gives them that. And there's good and true and beautiful stuff in popular culture, not because we're awesome or good. It's because God is awesome and good. So, look at these pieces of popular culture. Pay attention to what resonates with your heart as good and true and right, and sort of make a mental list. But you also need to understand why these grace fragments exist. They exist for God's glory, Acts 14:17. Yet He has not left Himself without testimony. He gives you crops in your seasons and food and fills your heart with joy. The implication is, if there's something that fills your heart with joy, that's good and true and excellent, it's there to point beyond itself to the character and existence of our Father. They belong properly to Him. So in your mind, kind of figure out how to put these things into a context which shows what does this show about God and His character and His story? Does a phrase in a song kind of kind of take your breath away with its beauty, its transcendent beauty? Does something in a film show you the hard and dirty truth about sinful humanity? Does a film capture the beauty of God's creation? Does a piece of dialogue kind of catch you the right way and just show you the joyousness of just being human and being funny? So these are signs, these moments of truth and beauty are signs that God has not abandoned his world. Look for them. They point to him. Let me give you an example. This is a song by Norah Jones called Humble Me. So what's the story here? You know, step one, what's the story? We don't get a lot of story, but we get enough. A woman, a single mom in an old car broken down outside of the road, calling up her ex, boyfriend, husband, we don't know, and saying, can you please come get me? I didn't want to turn to you, but I'm at the end of my rope. And is there any possibility for us to get together again? I've heard good things about you, and I'm just sorry about what happened. It was, I was at fault. And a lot of it's not told, but we get enough, right? So that's the basic story. What's the style and structure of this world? Notice the instrumentation. Very, very simple. Five instruments: voice, pump organ, guitar, bass. Okay, four instruments. That's it, I think. I think that's it. And just kind of very soft, plaintive, unassuming, simple. For those of you who know music, it's a very kind of very simple 6/8 time, very kind of gentle waltzing sort of thing. Very deliberate, slow. It would make no sense to have a kind of that would make no sense. The emotional mood that it's trying to set out is just very kind of bum bum bum. That pulse is important, and you can hear that in her voice too. It's not a strong voice. It's a very pain-filled voice. Where's the common grace here? Where's the common grace in this song? Well, there's just this heartbreaking vulnerability, fragility. It is a picture of repentance. I've done you wrong. I'm sorry. Can you please forgive me? And hopefully, you don't know whether she's going to be forgiven or not, but she's saying, is there a possibility? And then it ends there, which is a beautiful place to end. So that's common grace. You find these moments, so don't dismiss them. Of course, popular culture is not all about grace and light, is it? Popular culture is made by those who rebel against the light, and it shows in the popular cultural texts they produce. So spend some time thinking about step four. What is ugly and false and perverse? What does this imaginative world get wrong? Why is it wrong? What idols are being served? What is being set up as a God substitute? What is ultimately worthy of trust? Is it each other? Is it true love? Is it money? Is it sex, drugs, rock and roll? What? Where does this imaginative world lie about what is real? How does it twist reality? There was a friend of mine who, whenever he watched a movie with his daughter, they'd play a game called Spot the Hooey. Where is this film lying about reality? Where is it kind of giving you a line? So your job as an apologist is to locate and expose the idolatry. One thing to keep in mind, there's often a direct connection between the fragments of grace that I just talked about and the idol. One serves as a bait for the other. Nobody falls for an idol just because it's idolatry, it's idol-y or whatever. It's always baited with some good thing from God's creation. Like C.S. Lewis says, Satan has no power to create, only to distort, only to twist. So he baits and traps things with good things given by God, seduces us in like flies to honey, and then we're stuck and we're trapped and we become spiritually destroyed. It becomes addictive and it leads bad places. A few examples of contemporary idolatry found in popular culture. How many pop songs have you heard that proclaiming that romantic love can save the day, can save you, can make life meaningful if only you find that special someone? How many television shows have you seen that say all you really need is your friends, including, of course, friends, right? That will save you. That will make life meaningful, enable you to make it through life. Or how many Hollywood movies have you seen that say, you know, you just need to dig down and believe in yourself, man. You know, including every Disney movie from the last 30 years. Every single one. These are traps baited with the good things from God. But often exposing the trap helps it lose its power. You guys know the story of the emperor's new clothes? Yeah? You know, all you have to say is that idol's buck naked, and people go, huh? Really? You know, all you need is romantic love to save you. Really? All you need to find is the right guy or the right girl, and your life falls into place. Does it? Really? Has that been your experience of romantic love? Really? You know, was that your parents' experience, your divorced parents' experience of romantic love? All you really need is your friends. Don't friends let you down? You know, don't you let your friends down? Is that really going to be enough? Don't you let yourself down? Do you really, is believing in yourself enough? Do you really think that's going to make it all work? Now, please notice that these three things, romantic love, friends, and having a healthy self-esteem, all of these are good things. All of these are things that are created by God, blessings from God, but they don't work too well as gods themselves. People betray each other. Lovers lie. Friendships turn cold. You can fail others. You can even fail yourself. The idol cannot provide an adequate justification for the gifts it pretends to give. For those of you who are in the Advanced Apologetic Network, this is what I call transcendental justification. And if you weren't, then forget I ever said anything. No, it's just there's no way for the idol to say, yes, this really belongs to me. It shows that it belongs to God at the level of why, at the level of, you know, at the level of that kind of accountability. Can the idol show that the things that it says it gives, it can really give, given its own worldview assumptions? That's what I'm talking about. By pointing out the hollowness of the idol, you undermine its power and expose it for the lie it really is. Fifth step, how does the gospel apply here? To properly understand this step, you have to understand what I mean by gospel. What I don't mean by gospel is that Jesus died on the cross for your sins 2,000 years ago and was raised for your justification. That is the center of the gospel. That's the core of the gospel. What I mean by gospel here is what Paul talks about in 2 Corinthians 5:17. If anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. That's what the NIV says. That's not a good translation. If anyone is in Christ, the Greek reads, if anyone is in Christ, new creation. Just boom, new creation. In other words, if anyone is in Christ, there comes into being. There is a new creation. Not you are the new creation, but you have entered into a totally different order of existence where you can no longer look at anything the same ever again. So the gospel, thought of in that way as the new creation, as the thing that spawns this new creation, which started with the death and resurrection of Christ, that casts a new light on absolutely everything: family, sex, death, work, play, jobs, justice, identity. Everything is different now for the Christian. You have a new perspective on everything. So this final step involves showing how these good gifts fit within that the idol pretends to give actually are given and make sense within the context that the Christian worldview gives, the gospel-centered Christian worldview. How do these fragments of grace that you've seen, which the idol claims as its own, find their natural home within God's story of creation and redemption? When popular culture works, it works by stirring people's hearts, their desires for good things, things like reconciliation, true love, security, family, and so forth. But it does this by offering an idol and saying, here, O Israel, are your gods. You know, here's the thing that you really ought to be beholden to. The gospel responds by providing real and lasting answers to those desires, but in ways that show the merciful and powerful lordship of Christ. For example, when in a pop song there is a reunion between lovers that have, you know, reunited and it feels so good. You know, they come together at last and it's so wonderful and they're rejoicing in each other's arms. What is this, where does this really come from? Well, we know it comes from God, who is the ultimate lover. He is the triune God, and the persons of the Trinity have been in a love relationship, which makes romantic love look pale and jejune by comparison for all of eternity. He is a God of love, and he has created image, his image bearers, us, to be lovers. We are capable and have a tendency, have a predilection to love and be loved. And God actually came down and showed us what love looked like by sending his son to die so that his people who had been separated from him could be brought back into a love relationship with him. For example, see Ephesians 5:22 through 33, where Paul talks about husbands love your wives like Christ loved the church, and then he goes on and on and says, oh, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. But, you know, husbands should love their wives too. Or 1 John 3:16, this is how we know what love is. Christ died for us, and we ought to love each other. What does the gospel say about justice when the bad guy at the end of the movie finally gets his? What is this but a small reflection for justice that is deep within the human heart, that that we desire for the world to be set right? What does the gospel have to say about justice, about judging evil? Does it have anything to say? Yes. It says that the picture of good guys versus bad guys that Hollywood gives is very much oversimplified. And you're saying, Hollywood? Oversimplify? What? No, I'm shocked. No, the truth is, we're all bad guys. We all deserve God's judgment, but God executed judgment instead on his son to satisfy his justice and unleash his mercy upon us. Now we are forgiven bad guys who God loves, the sinners in whom God's Spirit is working out his righteousness and peace more and more. Furthermore, God puts into us a hunger for justice and peace to be his justice workers in the world. We long for God to come and make the world complete and new and just. And he's put into us a hunger to work with the widows and the orphans and the outcasts of our societies. To work with the racial minorities, the people who are marginalized in our societies. In this way, God sheds light in dark places and gives small tastes to us of the world made right. Popular culture is bursting with such fragments of grace, images and sounds and motifs of grace, grace distorted and twisted into serving idols. But these grace fragments can shine to their full potential once they are understood in a way that they were meant to be, as pointers to God's grace and beauty. The paths by which you can discuss these things with your friends are innumerable. There we go. Okay, if we could get the lights. Oh, it's in the same key. That's nice. So, what can we say about this?
Happy song.
Happy song. All right. Let's walk through our five steps. Right. Step number one. What's the story? Well, again, it's a song. It only gives us fragmentary pieces of story, but we can piece a little something together. A man who is trapped in a comfortable middle class existence. Such a pretty house. Such pretty flowers. You know, no shocks, no surprises, but it's killing him inside. It's killing his soul. It's suffocating him. And the imagery of the video puts that across with brutal and brilliant simplicity, you know, as he's going under the water. You know, just, so, step two, what sort of world is this? What sort of style and structure and moral, spiritual universe are we in? Well, first of all, notice the music. The music is kind of sedate, almost sing-songy. Na, 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 na. You know, the use of glockenspiel.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. What do you hear glockenspiel in? You hear it in marching band stuff and in fairy tale music for children. And that is just a really chilling juxtaposition, isn't it? So there's this nice little ditty, which is in, you know, stark contrast to this soul-killing thing that we hear about in the lyrics. But it really works. What kind of world is this? Again, we only have fragmentary information, but it's a world in which it's possible to fall into a stupor. People are beings with complex inner lives. They need stimulation, they need reality, they need meaning, rather than insulation and comfort. Too much comfort, they die. You know, so there's this idea of people who have souls that fill up like a landfill. You know, that it's like breathing carbon monoxide, you just become numb. There's also a sense of an oppression, a paranoia almost. So something is pressing down on us. There's something, it escapes our grasp. We're not quite sure what it is, but it's there and it threatens us. It's in the background, killing us somehow. So, step three. I'm going through this kind of quick, but you know, bear with me. What's good in this world and why? Does Thom Yorke get anything right? I would say yes. Can a comfortable middle-class life kill you spiritually? Is it possible to become addicted to the kind of comfortable middle-class life and be addicted to that which kills you? And I would say, yeah. I think he's drawn our eyes correctly to the way that an upper middle-class existence, a comfortable routine, can't really give us life, even though it promises it. It actually drains it away. And we become disengaged from what really matters. Step four, what's bad and how to subvert it? Where's the idolatry? This is harder to ask because this is harder to get an answer for because the song is mostly about pointing out the problem, diagnosing. But there is one place where it stops diagnosing and it actually proposes a kind of a solution of sorts. And it's just this bizarre non sequitur in the middle of the film. Yeah?
As a kind of face of a nihilistic approach?
Well, I wouldn't say it's nihilistic. I would say that there is definitely a belief in something. And this non sequitur gives us the key. The only one place, did anybody catch it? Bring down the government. They don't, you know, he's talking about everything's bad. Bring down the government. They don't speak for us. Why put that in there? It doesn't seem to be an overtly political song. Because that is, for Thom Yorke, the brightest hope in breaking this octopus-like joining of us to the things that will spiritually kill us. You know, the handshake of carbon monoxide. Political revolution will shake us out of our spiritual malaise. It will save us. However, yes?
I just wondered, did you mean that the fact that he says bring down the government is bad, or that that's the only thing in, that he brings up that indicates that there's anything wrong with his life? Do you know what I mean? Is it a bad choice for him to make, for us to make an objective?
Well, I would say the question is, in presenting a solution, it may be that he's presenting an idol, right? Is political revolution an evil in and of itself? It depends on how you have your political revolution, of course. Is political change a bad thing? Of course not. Are the hopes, the salvific hopes that are pinned to political revolution or political change bad news? Well, yeah, because that's not what political solutions, political change does. It doesn't heal what's broken inside. Right?
Scapegoat.
I'm not sure what you mean by scapegoat.
It
could be a scapegoating of the government where he really needs to take responsibility of what's his.
Yeah.
I'm not looking at that as much as I'm looking at what he looks to in hope for salvation. Right?
Okay.
So the question I want to ask is, can politics save? We often think it can. During the last presidential election in the United States, there was a lot of messianic expectation pinned to one man. And I remember saying back then, if he gets elected, look out, because there's no way he can live up to everything that people expected of him. For those of you listening at home, that's Obama. You know, I'm sure this is going into the archives and will be relevant 100 years later. So politics can do a lot of good, or it can do a lot of evil, but it doesn't change people spiritually. It doesn't fix what's broken inside of us. It is powerless to bring life to the dying, suffocating, comfortable middle class. Why? What is politics? Politics is all about arrangements and configurations of power in society. Who has control over the society's resources? Who's got control of the money? But can that change anything inside us? Or does it merely improve our conditions, if it improves our conditions? Or can improving our conditions make us spiritually better? I would say probably not. Saying that changing things politically will make things better inside for human beings, I think reduces human beings from being very complex creatures to being a political animal. And we are far more than political animals. We are political animals, but that nowhere near exhausts who we are as human beings. If you think politics can change you inside, you need look no farther than the failed Marxist experiments that were supposed to create the new socialist man. All the countries, at least in Czech Republic, where I'm doing my thing, you know, they were expecting, 1953, they were expecting the new socialist man. What they got were a bunch of corrupt old socialist men. You know, there was nothing new. All you did was change the power structure into something that was a lot more corrupt. Nothing changed spiritually. In fact, a lot got a lot worse spiritually. If anything, people became more dead inside because of the political changes. What the person in the song really needs is not a political change. As important as political change can be, he needs something else. And that leads us to step 5. How does the gospel apply here? I would argue that what this man really needs is something to live for, something that he can sink his life into, something to burn with passion for, something bigger and grander and more beautiful than he is. He hungers for justice, for meaning, for hope. He needs life and resurrection inside, and politics cannot give him that, not ultimately. But the good news is there is a God who raises the dead and brings the suffocating out into open, clean air, who sets our feet on a path where our lives actually mean something for a change. God sent his son into our depressing, deadening situation to die our death, to give our lives meaning and hope. He alone, Jesus alone, is vast and beautiful enough to give myself over to without reservation. And God may lead us into work for struggle for political change, but we need to do so without illusions. There is only so much that politics can change. It changes the outside. It changes the conditions, which is important. And I think Christians, I'm not trying to enter into a dualism here, but it's not going to raise the dead inside. He alone can make us alive when we are dying inside. Under the Spirit's influence, we can engage our world then meaningfully and bring real change and hope. So, let me conclude, and thank you for staying with me for so long. Popular culture is an overwhelming category. It is way too much for any one Christian, including myself, to take on. I would argue that, however, I would argue that this is our mission field, right? Or maybe better, mission fields. So, or maybe better, mission fields. Think of media's genres, subgenres, as types of mission fields, each with its own people who need to be reached with the gospel. What type of popular culture are you naturally drawn to? What type of popular culture are you geared up and fired up about gaining some fan expertise in, right? For that is what you must do if you are to reach other fans within that particular field. We must speak their language. We have to walk a bit in their shoes. Instead of rejecting and fearing popular culture, perhaps God is calling you to become a missionary to the metalheads, or an ambassador to the anime community, or Christ's go-between for computer gamers, or his diplomat to the dance club. By becoming familiar with the language of popular culture, learning how to critically and imaginatively engage popular culture, we will begin speaking the worldview vernacular, that is the common tongue of the people who live out there, their native religions. So, that's my presentation. I can take questions, or we can do another workshop example. And the question was, is there any time when popular culture is so full of idolatry and just nastiness that you don't want to engage it? And I would say, absolutely. I would point to three things you need to be three rules of thumb for those of us with three thumbs. Number one is know your own heart. Know the idols of your own heart. There are, I'm totally against Christians laying down the law for other Christians about popular culture, because the heart is so variable. There are different strengths and weaknesses, and I think we need to be very reticent for those who are weak in conscience to come down and make judgments for those who are strong in conscience. As it is also incumbent upon those who are strong in conscience not to draw in those who feel that it would violate their consciences. So for me, I gotta really watch sexual content, right? I mean, there are some people that does not bother at all. For me, that leads me in bad places. So I gotta be really careful about that and think through. And there have been, we do a movie discussion night, and there was a movie a couple of years back, Monsters Ball, which would have been a really good movie night discussion, but you would have to sit through Halle Berry and Billy Bob Thornton going at it for 10 minutes. And when I watched it, when I previewed it, you know, I had to kind of fast forward through that scene, and I was like, I am not going to show something that I have to fast forward through. You know, that's just silly. We can find another movie. So there's that. Know your own heart. If there's something that's going to drag you down and lead you into sin, avoid that. You know, in anything I say, I do not mean to lead Christians into sin. The second thing is, there are going to be things that don't tempt you, but are so just freaking nasty that it would just leave you kind of feeling stained. And I would say, you can stay clear of that too. You know, even if it's not a temptation. I tell this about this in the book. I went to a Christian boarding school, and some guy got I don't know who it was. Nobody knew where this thing came from. It was a record by a band called Throbbing Gristle. You know, I can't make this stuff up. And they recorded their albums at a studio called the Death Factory. And it was just this guitar-driven cacophony with this tortured voice narrating unspeakable acts of sexual violence done upon a pregnant woman. And when it first came into the dorm, you know, people would go like, "Ah, I'm going to be the rebellious kid." But after they'd actually listened to it, they said, "Get this thing the hell out of my room," you know. And it just kind of went around the dorm like a lost puppy without a home for a while, until it ended up in the trash, which is, I think, where it belonged. Because it was just, why would you do that? You know, why would you make something like that? Why would you listen to something like that? And that threshold is going to be different for other people. I know a woman who cannot deal with the short stories of Flannery O'Connor. I think she's brilliant. This is Christian culture of the first order, but it's too dark for her, and she can't deal with that. It doesn't tempt her. It's just, you know, and so I would not invite her to a reading. You know, I would not send her short stories by Flannery O'Connor. And the third thing to know, which is something, even if you're analytically aware, still kind of creeps up on you, is understand or try to understand the emotional baggage attached to the piece of popular culture you're dealing with. That is, even if you analyze it, even if you suss out the idolatry and stuff like that, there's still an imaginative framework there that has the tendency to cling, and you can't analyze that stuff out. You can't analyze yourself free from that. You have to just sort of let it fade. There, for instance, anybody know Ender's Game? It's a science fiction book. Great science fiction book. Great science fiction series about this young, immensely gifted boy named Ender, who is kind of manipulated by the government into becoming sort of a human weapon for them, and a strategic genius. And they do all sorts of by making him. Oh no, I'm gonna end up spoiling the novel for anybody who wants to read it. I'm not gonna tell you the ending. I'm not gonna tell you anything more. But just, it has to do with this kind of, this manipulation of this child who never really gets to be a child because he's having to do all these war games and things, and these exercises. And I got through the novel, and for like a week or two, I was just snapping at people and just in a really bad mood. And I could not for a while figure out why. You know, and I said, why am I just so angry about, and I don't have anything to be angry about. And I realized I was living in this guy's head, this kid's head, night after night as I was reading myself to sleep. And that just kind of sinks in, and you just have to let it pass. You know, my daughter talks about Don Bluth films in her childhood. Don Bluth was a Disney animator who didn't like the way Disney kind of sweetened everything and wanted to do something a little edgier. So he's the king of off-brand Disney sorts of cartoons. Things like The Rats of Nim and Anastasia and all of these things. And my daughter loved them at a very early age. But they're really, really, and I kind of, parenting fail, I did not watch these things enough with her. They were just really dark from color palette, lots of deep purples, blacks, blood reds, especially in Anastasia. And just creepy characters. One of the bad guy in Anastasia kind of removes his eyeball and uses, you know, and purportedly, I don't know if this is true, he said, you know, you can get away with anything in a children's movie as long as you give it a happy ending. And my daughter was just addicted to these things, and it just kind of gave her this craving for dark things. She's not exactly a goth, but she's kind of gothy, you know. She's 17, you know, and she said, "And I knew you wouldn't want me to get into it, so I didn't tell you when I was 5 years old," you know. And I was like, you know, so you just gotta watch out as a parent, watch out as a person, you know. Just watch out for that stuff. It's so I, I've I think to a large degree, we escape the idols that are presented in culture if we become aware of them and kind of suss them out. And actually, one of the things I don't mention here is step four into step five is really a moment of worship, right? So you can make every piece of popular culture into an occasion for worship if you understand it correctly. But there is still this imaginative, emotional thing that kind of climbs on your back and clings there. After seeing Saving Private Ryan, there was one scene in it where this German soldier kills an American soldier while saying again and again in German, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry," while they're struggling over a knife and the knife gets lower and lower. That scene stayed with me for years. You know, I've never seen the movie again because of it. You just got to be aware of that stuff. So engage what you can engage, but know what you're doing. Know your own heart. Know what's going to stain you, and reckon with the emotional baggage. Yes, sir.
On the flip side of that, do you see a danger in desensitizing ourselves? So.
That is a danger, and on one sense, I want to say, you know, if you're going into a movie and you know it to be artifice. And you're saying, oh, okay, that's... I have a friend, a dear Christian friend, you know, just crazy in love for Jesus. He's a special effects makeup artist. And he's the guy who, in these little B-horror movies, is the one who does all the blood and all of this stuff. And so when he's watching a movie, it's a very different experience from when I'm watching a movie. You know, he's just saying, I see what you did there. That's very good, you know. And he kind of approaches it with that kind of eye. And even for an amateur, I think you can go into it and kind of say, oh, bravo on the exploding body or whatever, you know. And that's okay. It's when you start noticing that you're watching the news with the same eyes that you're watching the movie with, that's when you're in trouble. And I would say at that point, you probably need to stop. You probably need to tone down, to shift. And because at that point it's not about fictive, you know, manipulation and knowingly doing that. It's about degrading the human person.
It's a sense of reality.
Yeah. It's eroding your sense of reality. So I don't watch the kind of horror films that just kind of feed off of that thing. Even though for some people. It's a very powerful and acceptable thing. That's not where I can go. Also, I was talking to a friend in the hallway, and he was saying, you know, now that I have children, I can't watch films the same way. I can't watch television the same way. So there are things that kind of resensitize you to violence as well as desensitize. So can I just offer a short word of prayer before we go? Dear Father, please bless these brothers and sisters of mine. Please let them take away what is good and according to your word, and let them discard the rest. I pray, Lord, that you would bless them in their ministries and help them use popular culture in ways that are challenging and encouraging and inviting and winsome to people who don't know you, and glorifying to you and revealing of you for those who do. In your son's name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
For those of you who want more resources, I have a website, www.turnau.cz. And you'll find articles there. Huh?
CZ.
CZ, sorry. CZ. My last name, dot C, last letter of the alphabet.